it's worth remembering, and the BLA do talk about this a lot, but it's worth remembering that laryngology is about more than voice. Laryngology is voice, airway, and swallow. All those three things are really critical in their own right. I would just say for singers, don't be fearful of coming to see a laryngologist. It's always nice when a patient is pleasantly surprised at how straightforward it is to have a laryngoscopy. It's not remotely as traumatic as you might have thought.
Welcome to BLA Connections, A Clear Voice, to the second episode of Series 5. I'm your host, Natalie Watson, and I'm delighted to bring you discussions and insights from experts from across the globe on all things laryngology. In today's episode, we explore what it's like to be a singer and a laryngologist, talking to our BLA president, Mr. Declan Costello. Declan Costello is a consultant, ear, nose and throat surgeon specialising in voice disorders. He studied music at St John's College, Cambridge, where he was a choral scholar and went on to study medicine at Imperial College. As a singer himself, he has a particular interest in treating voice disorders in performers. He has published a number of books and has written many chapters, including the chapter on larynx for the 42nd edition of Gray's Anatomy. As well as being our current president of the British Laryngological Association, he is on the Presidential Council of the European Laryngological Society. You may have read his excellent editorials as editor of ENT and Audiology News, and he is an examiner for the EBE ORLHNS. He runs frequent courses on vocal anatomy and health for singers and other performers, and gives lectures around the world on voice-related topics. He continues to sing regularly and with several groups, including the Holst Singers. Thank you so much for joining us today, Declan.
It's lovely to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
So it's a pleasure to have you on. What is your singing background? We've alluded to it a little bit, but expand on that.
Well, At school, I sang in school choirs. I was a good singer. I wasn't a particularly serious singer, and I certainly wasn't a chorister in one of the cathedrals or anything, but I did quite a lot of singing at school. And as I went through my schooling, it looked like I was going to become a medic. Both my parents were medics, and it looked like I was going to go into that. But then as I went through sixth form, my voice started improving, and it looked like I might want to do a choral scholarship. And at that time, you couldn't do a choral scholarship where I wanted to go, which was St John's, Cambridge. You couldn't do that and study medicine at the same time because they're both too time consuming. And I thought I would study music and enjoyed that very much. The music course at Cambridge was quite academic, but the singing I did as a choral scholar, you know, we were singing seven times a week. So there was loads of music going on. And then halfway through the music degree, I realized that actually I did want to study medicine after all. So I finished the 3 years of music, applied to medical school, and then did a further 5 years of study and carried on doing some singing while I was at Imperial. I did some deputising, some depping in the cathedrals around London and sang with various other groups, and have carried on singing since then.
I mean, it's brilliant that you kept your interest all throughout medicine as well. And that's obviously what we advise people to do now, because you need that outlet, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think the singing I did tailed off quite a lot after I started as a junior doctor, just because we had young kids and there isn't time and this and that. But actually, as I got a bit more senior, there was more time to do singing. And you're right, I think it's really important that people keep up their interests. When prospective medical students come in for work experience placements in my clinic, quite often they're very young and they don't really know what they want to do, but they just feel that they're sort of on this treadmill without ever really having thought about it properly. And I always say to them, look, if you enjoy Spanish, or you enjoy history of art, or you enjoy music, go off and do that for a few years. There's no great harm in that. It's not a race to the finish. And if you want to study medicine afterwards, like I did, then that's perfectly possible. So do what you enjoy doing. But you're right, it's easy to become quite one-dimensional in medicine, I think, if all you ever do is to work.
Yeah, it's good for the well-being of everyone, isn't it?
Very much.
It's a marathon and not a sprint, as you said. So now this is quite a loaded question, this next question. Was singing the biggest influence in making the decision to be a laryngologist in particular?
Yes, I think it was. I mean, when I left medical school, I didn't know that I was going to go into ENT. I did, as an SHO, I did some orthopedics, I did some plastics, I did some A&E. I really enjoyed all of those. But actually, when I did my ENT SHO jobs, I enjoyed those and decided I wanted to apply for a specialist training post in ENT. And then having got into ENT, it was fairly clear from early on that laryngology was going to be what I wanted to do. And laryngology, you know, when this is 15 years ago, but laryngology was a very, very, very small niche. So I was painting myself into a little bit of a corner. As I got more and more senior in my training, it looked a little bit unlikely that I was going to find a post to slot into. But I was very lucky to get a job at the Queen Elizabeth in Birmingham soon after I finished my training. So it worked out well.
That's exactly how I felt. I was thinking, yeah. Am I really boxing myself in too much of a little niche here?
But we're lucky because laryngology is an expanding specialty. And actually, over the last few years, with you and with a number of other appointments around the UK, laryngology, I think, is increasingly being recognised as an important subspecialty. And that's something we definitely need to push for with our medical training authorities, for sure.
Absolutely. And that's why we're doing so much work with the SAC and trying to work on the curriculum to really highlight how varied and diverse airway, swallow and voice is in laryngology and how essential it is for everyone.
Yeah, absolutely.
So do you think it helps being a singer and a laryngologist? And do you think it's essential?
So to answer the second part of that question first, no, I don't think it's essential. It's worth remembering, and the BLA do talk about this a lot, but it's worth remembering that laryngology is about more than voice. Laryngology is voice, airway and swallow. All those three things are really critical in their own right. But with regards to voice, I mean, no, I don't think it's essential to be a singer, to be a laryngologist. You're a singer yourself, and you know, you will know that it's nice to be able to talk to singers in a language they will understand, and actually to have some sort of empathetic relationship where if somebody's talking about a particular piece of music or a particular phrase or a particular scenario when you're performing, actually to have lived that and to have experienced it yourself and to know what it feels like to be in that moment, I think is really helpful. And the singers really appreciate being able to have those sorts of conversations. But is it essential? No. I mean, the majority of patients I see in the run of my practice obviously are not singers. I do see a lot of singers in my practice, but most people are not singers. But I think if you're going to be a laryngologist who is seeing a lot of singers, if you're not a singer yourself, you do have to make an effort to understand different repertoires, different genres of music, what different eras of classical music sound like and how the different voice types fit in with those and the different demands on particular voices if you're singing Handel versus if you're singing Wagner or Verdi. You know, they're very, very different beasts.
And I guess we can make a similarity with orthopedics. If you are a knee surgeon and you want to know what are the stresses, what are the impacts, what's the exercise regime that this person is doing, you know, are they a skier, are they a footballer? And in that way, you have to kind of understand what you're doing and what consequences that will have for that individual person. And again, it's just having that insight. It doesn't mean that you have to be the best footballer in the world, but as long as you're the best orthopedic surgeon, it's okay.
No, that's right. And I think it's no surprise that the orthopaedic surgeons who specialise in foot and ankle, I mean, I don't know who James Anderson's foot and ankle surgeon is, for example, but I suspect that the person who does James Anderson's foot and ankle is him or herself a sports person and understands precisely the forces and the difficulties that they're going through. And again, in the same way as with laryngology, as you say, can have those conversations about how they're striking the ground. And in the same way that we work very closely with speech and language therapists and with voice coaches, an orthopedic surgeon will be working with very specialist physiotherapists and with sports coaches as well on foot strike and that sort of thing.
It's really the understanding, isn't it, of their world.
Yeah, exactly.
So is there a downside to being a singer?
I can't think of any particular downsides to being a singer in the laryngology world. No, I mean, occasionally patients will talk to me about very, very small niches of repertoire, and I have to sort of go, well, can you explain that to me a bit? Because I don't think I've heard of that person. So I feel like a bit of a numbskull at times like that. But no, I don't think there's a particular disadvantage. I think it's important to have a bigger picture view of voice disorders, particularly when you're not seeing a singer necessarily. It always interests me that patients who are singers clearly are very locked into how their voices feel. And when you're examining them and getting them to do particular vocal gestures with the endoscope in, they're very, very good at mimicking. When I'm seeing a patient who's not a singer and you ask them to pitch a particular note so that you can see their larynx moving, it always interests me when somebody chimes in on a completely different note and you think, okay, fine, so I'm not necessarily seeing a singer here. And I think a lot of music, a lot of singing in particular, is about mimicry actually, and your ability to hear a sound and then actually to reproduce that. But that's just about a musical ear, I think, as much as anything.
Absolutely. Talking a little bit more clinically now, what are the common pathologies you see in singers?
Well, the majority of the time, a singer who comes to see me has a particular problem in part of their range, often in their upper registers. And I guess the most common pathology would be small blemishes, I would call them, on the free medial vibrating edge of the vocal folds. It's always very interesting having conversations with singers about pathology. And part of the trick, I think, is to explain things in a way that is kind and accurate and thoughtful, but that doesn't induce absolute gut-wrenching fear in them that this is the end of their careers. Because when a singer walks through the clinic door, their morbid fear is that actually this is the end of their working life. And that particularly applies to vocal fold nodules, that there is an absolute pathological fear in singers of having nodules for historical reasons, I guess. So explaining pathology in a kind way that allows people to understand and realize that this is not the end of the world, I think is a very important thing to do. So I guess in answer to your question about what the commonest pathologies are, the majority of the time for singers who come through, actually there is no definable mucosal pathology necessarily, but of the pathologies that come through, I guess a unilateral pseudocyst or a small polyp or something along those lines would be the most common. Nodules are reasonably common. I actually try not to use the word nodules precisely because of the fear it induces in singers. I talk about anterior vocal fold swellings or contact lesions or thickenings of the vocal folds and these sorts of things. And then every once in a while, a patient will come through the door who's had an acute hemorrhage. And, you know, that leads on to its own issues and how you manage that. Reflux, I mean, reflux is just such a huge and contentious topic. I, perhaps slightly controversially, take the view that you really can't diagnose reflux based on what you see in the larynx unless they've got gross redness and you can see acid billowing up into the larynx. So I think the last 20 years have been interesting, to say the least, about how we've managed reflux. And I think we're coming to a slightly more nuanced view of it now.
All those persistent throat symptoms. And it's one of the most popular podcasts, actually, in series 4 with James O'Hara, talking about persistent throat symptoms and our changing views of reflux, whether it's a thing or whether it's part of a thing. And I think it's obviously got some further exploration to go.
Yeah, refinement. Yeah, and James O'Hara is extremely good on talking about this, very sensible, very pragmatic. And Janet Wilson before him, again, had a very sort of sensible view of things and didn't oversell the reflux side of things. We in the past 20 years, we've been very, very wedded to PPIs. And fortunately now, I think we're moving away from that, which is a good thing.
So we've talked about what common pathologies you see in singers. Do you approach the assessment and treatment of singers, as in medical treatment and surgical treatment of singers, any differently than you do with non-singers?
Yes, I think the approach is different from lots of different points of view. If you saw a subtle little swelling on one vocal fold in a non-singer, and if their voice was causing them very little in the way of problems, you would probably leave that alone by and large, assuming you were confident it was benign. In a singer, that lesion may only be causing very subtle intermittent problems in their uppermost registers. And if you're not a singer, that wouldn't have caused a problem. But actually, for a singer who can't sustain a top C, that is potentially a career-ending thing. So I'm much more prone to addressing small lesions surgically in a singer than I would be in a non-singer, with the caveat that I'm not gung-ho when it comes to surgery in singers, and I will obviously try all means possible through voice coaching and voice therapy and other measures to try to avoid that if possible. But if a singer has come to a fork in the road where they either stop singing or they have something fairly radical done, like an operation for a small lesion, then sometimes it does come to that. I think also the psychology and the timing of approaching an operation for a singer is really important if that's the route you're going to go down. Singers very often will just want to get it done as soon as possible, just get it done. But actually, the recovery period after an operation, depending on the nature of the lesion, but the recovery period is a number of weeks. And they need to just factor that in and just build in some headspace. And if that means working around the lesion for the next couple of months before you plan to do an operation, and that then gives them 2 or 3 months afterwards to recuperate, then so be it, rather than rushing into it now and trying to get through it as rapidly as possible.
Yes, I'm always very cognizant of that as well, you know, because most of them are self-employed and therefore actually taking 2 to 3 months out of work, which is basically what we're forcing them to do after a surgery. It's really quite a challenge financially.
It's huge, yeah, it really is. And actually, there are the organisations in the UK that have been enormously helpful over the last few years are the British Association of Performing Arts Medicine, BAPAM, and Help Musicians UK, HMUK, who provide practical advice and signposting to the relevant professionals. But also in HMUK's case, they provide funding for singers and performers as well who need medical intervention. So, no, they're absolutely fantastic. But you're right, having surgical procedures as a singer, if that's the route you're going to have to go down, it is not a cheap way to go. It really is not. No.
But sometimes it is necessary if that's what they want to do to try and get through the troubles, and it's our duty to kind of help them through that and counsel them along the way.
Absolutely.
Any final words from you? Anything you want to leave the listeners with?
I guess if there are singers listening, you know, we've talked a lot about pathology and things that can go wrong and recovery periods and all the rest of it. I would just say for singers, and I say this when I do talks for singers around the place, don't be fearful of coming to see a laryngologist. I think there was a time, perhaps a couple of generations ago, when going to see a laryngologist was a slightly traumatic experience, and the techniques for examining people were a lot more unpleasant than they are now. It's always nice when a patient is pleasantly surprised at how straightforward it is to have a laryngoscopy. It's not remotely as traumatic as you might have thought. And you know, the other thing is that for singers, they quite often will have problems for a number of weeks or months and have been worried about going to see a laryngologist for fear of what might be found, and they leave it, and then suddenly 3 or 4 months down the line, they're psychologically, they're in an absolute pickle, and then come in a bit of a watery mess. And actually, if they had been able to draw a line under it sooner and come after just a few weeks and moved on, I think that would have been very beneficial for them. So, you know, get to see a laryngologist sooner rather than later. Keep a video of your larynx as well. I think it's very useful for singers to have a video of their larynx. And for the laryngologists and SLTs who are listening, be kind and sympathetic to the singers you see. If you're not sure of what you are looking at, or if you think there's something that you're missing, by all means chat to colleagues. I speak to colleagues all the time about subtle this and subtle that, and asking for second opinions. Have networks of people you can engage with.
Absolutely. Collaboration is the key.
Yeah.
So all, thank you so much for joining us today, sharing your experience of being a singer and a laryngologist, and highlighting the nuances of looking after the singing population.
Pleasure. Thank you very much, Natalie. Lovely talking to you.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to BLA Connections, A Clear Voice. I have been your host, Natalie Watson. Please do tune in this series for more laryngology topics. We would also love to hear from you. Please feel free to email with any topics you would like us to explore, any questions you have, along with any suggested experts you would like to hear from. Also, if you'd like to contribute to these podcasts, please email inquiries@britishlaryngological.org. Our full series can be found in the podcast provider of your choice, or you will find all stored on our BLA Connect app for easy access. Thank you to all our listeners, and we hope you found our podcast informative. Please remember to subscribe and do leave a review with your podcast provider. We do appreciate your likes, subscribes, and reviews.